Historical Reliability of the Bible, the third talk in a series entitled Authority of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 21, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I was arguing that there's really no basis and no ground for the authority of tradition. I have a basis for granting authority to the scriptures, but what basis do I have for granting authority to tradition? I simply asserted that I don't have a corresponding basis for doing so. The question came up, well, what about the authority of Scripture? What is our basis for granting authority to Scripture? And I kind of take that for granted. We haven't talked about that a lot. So they asked, and I agreed that it would be important that we address that issue here. So I'm going to kind of, on an aside, step aside and address that issue for the next couple weeks. With respect to that, well, okay, my basic reason for granting authority to Scripture is because Jesus did so. And the prior question is, why listen to Jesus? And my answer in the end is going to be, well, duh. He's the Messiah. I mean, who else are you going to listen to? But there's two issues. One, on what basis do I know that he's the Messiah? Well, on the basis of what he said and did. But how do I know what he said and did? I have historical documents that tell me what he said and did. And what did he teach about Scripture? What was his attitude toward Scripture? I only know that from historical documents that tell me what his attitude toward Scripture was. What if none of that stuff is true? So really, the first question that any Christian needs to confront is the historical reliability of the Bible itself, not the authority of the Bible. That's a different question. But you can separate out the question of the historical reliability of the Scriptures on the one hand and the absolute, infallible, inerrant authority of the Bibles on the other hand. Those are different issues. They could be historically reliable without being authoritative. But how on earth would we ever know that they are authoritative in the way that we're inclined to view them if we don't get our information from historically reliable documents in the Scriptures? So whether we like it or not, it seems to me, I mean, we can try to just sort of stick our head in the sand and ignore the issue and wish it would go away. And part of what I'm going to say this morning is kind of an apologetic for why we felt comfortable doing that, or why we do feel comfortable doing that when we do. But ultimately, the fact of the matter is, if the biblical texts are not historically reliable, we don't know what we're talking about. We have no basis for believing what we believe. So whether we like it or not, it's a crucial issue that we have to confront, it seems to me. So what I want to address this morning is just give you my own personal take and my own personal reflections on why I believe that the biblical accounts do give me accurate information about what was actually said and about what actually happened in the life and times of Jesus. The question is, how do I know that all those stories about what Jesus said and did are not just myths and legends and tales and exaggerated stories about somebody? How do I know that? Well, I'm going to just reflect on that question and how I would go about thinking about that question. Well, the first point, and should be on the first point on your sheet there, is that given the God-created nature of human rationality, the default response of a rational human being is to believe another person's testimony with respect to what they claim to know or claim to have seen. Credulity, and what I mean by credulity is the tendency to believe something. Credulity per se is not weak, it's not gullible, It's not irresponsible. It's not irrational. On the contrary, it's eminently rational. The one who first drew this to my attention was the Scottish common sense philosopher Thomas Reid, who actually describes one of his principles, of foundational principles of human reason, what he calls the principle of credulity. And he simply points out the obvious. Do you know what big trouble we were in if rationality didn't operate on the principle of credulity? Look how utterly trusting children are. No matter what you tell them as parents, they believe you. Why is that so crucial? Because they have to go from 0 to 60 in less than 3 months. I mean, they have to be, the learning curve for a child is very, very sharp. If he can't let you pass on to him what you know, then he won't even survive in this world, let alone get smart. So built into the very nature of the way we learn and reason is our tendency to be able and willing to learn from other people. Tell me what the truth is. Tell me what you know. Tell me what you've seen. And I will accept that and make that a part of my view of reality so that I can know too and so that I can understand reality better. Well, my contention is that's fundamentally a rational way to proceed, not an irrational way to proceed. And one of the biggest lies that has been foisted on Western civilization is the tendency coming out of the Enlightenment, and they only use it very selectively, notice, but the tendency coming out of the Enlightenment to persuade each and every one of us that unless you know of your own accord and have seen it with your own eyes and know it by your own arguments and your own reasoning, you have no right to believe it. You have no right to trust other people. Well, my contention is, if we actually proceeded that way, that would be anti-intelligent. Unintelligent. Stupid. That would be a stupid way to proceed through life. So we have to recognize that the reverse is the case. We have to have good reason not to believe, not good reason to believe. And my reason and my intelligence tells me that. And I operate that way as my default mode all the time in ordinary life. I mean, I believe Australia exists. But can you believe a more fanciful tale? Kangaroos, duck-billed platypuses. Come on. There's no such place. And yet I do believe it. It seems credible to me, given the testimony, the nature of the testimony by other people. The objection, of course, let me stop and tell you a story. I remember hearing someone was in a class that I was teaching, and they told me of a relative, I believe, or a friend or an acquaintance of theirs, who taught their child when she was in preschool the color spectrum. You know, the rainbow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, they just shifted the spectrum. So they taught, I'm going to have trouble here, but they taught the child to call orange, red, yellow, orange. You got it? Just shifted the spectrum down. That is one of the cruelest things we could do. I mean, what an incredible, irresponsible act of cruelty, because it's exploiting this implicit trust that a child has in their parent, and which the child relies on, is at the mercy of the parent to teach them the truth. And just as a little parlor game, mix up the color spectrum for them, that's really bizarre. It just seems sick to me. But what makes that work, what makes that possible, is the credulity, the inbuilt, God-given credulity of the child. Now, the objection that would get raised is, but people lie. We know from experience that people lie. They don't tell the truth. We don't just trust what people say. we learn who we can trust and who we can't trust. Well, to answer that objection, though, think about it for a second. Lying wouldn't work if that were true. We are exploiting the credulity of other people when we lie. We know that their tendency is going to be to believe us. We know that they want to believe us. We know that they are inclined to believe us, and that's why we can deceive them. If there were a 50-50 chance that everyone, every time anybody said anything to me, was going to tell me something false, how would lying work? I'd be on my guard all the time. I'd be skeptical all the time. I wouldn't be believing people. I'd be skeptical. But it works precisely because the principle of credulity is a valid part of human intelligence and human rationality. The truth of the matter is that we must learn through experience to be cautious and wary. We don't need to learn to trust. We need to learn to distrust. And it's experience that tells us that. Ordinary sound rationality bids us to trust other people. Wisdom born of experience among sinful mankind bids us to be wary. So the significance of this first point with regard to the scripture is that if the testimony of the writers of the New Testament is that they saw Jesus appear to them after he had died and been buried in the tomb, then it, on the face of it, that is after initial consideration, on the face of it, it's rational for us to believe them and take their testimony at face value. If they say they saw Jesus walking on water, on the face of it, why would they be telling me that if they didn't see Jesus walking on the water? On the face of it, it's rational to assume that they're trying to convey the truth to me of what they actually saw and were actually eyewitness to. Okay, the second point then, on the other hand, experience teaches us that other people do not always tell the truth when they report to us about what they claim to know or have seen. Their reports may be false for any number of different reasons. One, because they're deliberately lying to us, and people lie for many reasons, to defraud, to escape shame, to escape embarrassment, to be cruel, because they're afraid and they want to keep themselves safe somehow and think that lying is a strategy to do that. Many, many different reasons people might lie, but people do lie, we learn from experience. Now, in order for me to conclude that somebody is lying to me, it has to be plausible that that person who's reporting something to me is being motivated by something that typically can motivate lying. To just say they're lying just because I want to say they're lying makes no sense. Why would they lie to me unless there was some reason that's identifiable, plausible, why they would lie to me? A report by somebody else could be false not because they're lying, but because they have been successfully lied to by others, deceived by others. And then, while they themselves are sincere in believing the reliability of what they're telling me, what they're reporting to me, nevertheless, the source and the basis of their knowledge is unreliable because they have been deceived into believing it. A good liar can sometimes succeed in deceiving a rational human being, even when that rational human being is being duly cautious and wary. So, you know, if I'm going to conclude that someone is passing on to me information that's based on a lie, that becomes more plausible the more convinced I am that the person reporting it to me has not been sufficiently cautious and wary. The more I'm convinced of that, then the more plausible it is that even though they're sincere, they were lied to. Third reason why people pass on reports that are not true is that they themselves, while they are sincere in their beliefs, they accept their claims, their own claims, on rationally inadequate grounds. And there are a number of reasons why people might do that. You know, why would we believe something that we believe on rationally inadequate grounds? Well, perhaps they're eagerly seeking evidence to justify some prior commitments on their commitments to a specific belief or commitments to a specific worldview. And it's a prior commitment that they've made, not on rational grounds, but on some kind of psycho-emotional grounds, social-political grounds, or even moral-spiritual grounds. That is, they don't believe what they believe because rationality tells them it's true. They believe what they believe because it fills some other need that they are feeling or experiencing. A psychological need, an emotional need. It will help stave off fear. It will help keep them safe, they think. They're committed to some cause, and it's very important to them for other emotional reasons that their cause be right and that their cause be upheld. There can be any number of reasons why we might make a prior commitment to some worldview or some belief other than because it's rational. In that case, but we know how human it is to do that. In that case, sometimes human beings find themselves in a position where they would rather have their non-rational need met than meet their need to be rational. And sometimes we give greater weight to our psychological and emotional needs rather than to our epistemological needs, if you will, our need to be rational, our need to know. I would argue it's never right to do that. I would argue that that's a function of our sinfulness. That's a function of our compromise, the compromising of our being as human beings. We were made to be always and imminently rational in that which we are willing to embrace as true. But alas and unfortunately, we're not always willing to be rational. Sometimes we'd rather be irrational and get some other need met. But notice that you see the truth of that in the very act itself. Because when we place something above rationality, notice that we always rationalize the belief that is not held for rational reasons. We always create some kind of argument, some kind of make some kind of move to try to suggest, no, I'm being rational, even though I am not. But we always want to appear like we're being rational, even to ourselves, I think. Because fundamentally, we can't rid ourselves of that fundamental notion that we know that we need to be rational, that it's right to be rational, that it's good to be rational. So we rationalize. The significance of this point with respect to Scripture is that we have to concede, we have to face into the fact that it's entirely possible that the biblical accounts do not depict the historical events accurately. I can't dismiss out of hand the possibility that the biblical accounts are based on fraud, based on deception, or based on misjudgment. I don't think the way to respond to that possibility is just by dogmatically rejecting it. I think we need to acknowledge that it's a very real possibility. Yeah, okay. And if the biblical accounts are based on fraud, deception, and misjudgment, then we have no business believing what we believe, at least not in the way that we believe it. Okay, third point. Skepticism is not the rational response to the human situation. What I mean by this human situation here is skepticism is not the rational response to the fact that we cannot trust human beings implicitly. That our experience tells us that you can't trust human beings implicitly. And one could decide to respond to that fact with skepticism, but I'm arguing that's not the rational response. Rather, the rational response is to believe the reports of other people unless we are aware of some reason to hold that report suspect. That is, to give the report the benefit of the doubt unless there's some reason to not do so. The reason I would argue that that's the rational response, what I mean by skepticism, first of all, what I mean by skepticism is just this a priori, that's a word you're familiar with, that from the get-go, from the outset, before we even know what we're talking about, I'm just going to be skeptical. You know, I don't even know what you're going to tell me yet, but I can tell you I'm going to be skeptical toward it. That would make it a priori, where the stance that I'm going to take toward any report, no matter what it is, that might come to me into the future, I'm not going to believe it until you convince me, until you prove it somehow. That would be skepticism. Skepticism is not the rational response to our situation. And the reason I know it's not our rational response is because we don't do it. Who of us is consistently skeptical? The fact of the matter is, we all know we can't live that way. We can't bring ourselves to live that way. We don't want to live that way. There's nothing about skepticism that ultimately recommends itself to us. The only skeptics are philosophers while they're in their office with their feet on the desk, smoking the pipe in their mouth. Then they can be skeptics. But the minute they stick their feet on the ground and walk down the hall, they cease being skeptics. They go out the door, not the wall, of their office because they believe the evidence of their own senses. They meet somebody in the hall and they tell them that there's a memo in his box from the dean, and they go check their box. You know, they don't go, yeah, prove it. I mean, we just don't operate that way, and we can't operate that way, nor should we operate that way. It would be unintelligent to operate that way. So as much as it may on the surface, and I think largely for cultural reasons, seem like a kind of responsible and intelligent thing to do, skepticism is ultimately not intelligent. It's unintelligent, anti-intelligent. What's interesting is how much we have been convinced that we need to apply a different standard when it comes to the Bible. That when it comes to the Bible, we need to be skeptical toward the biblical accounts in a way that we're not normally skeptical in ordinary everyday life. But why? They're just historical documents, right? So if they're just historical documents, we should treat them the same way we would treat any other historical document, not with some sort of extra dose of skepticism. Anyone that we would find and run into who is consistently skeptical, we would consider it pathological. The person is psychologically unhinged in some way. They are deeply disturbed in a way that allows them to trust nothing. And that's not an epistemological issue. That has become a psychological issue, it seems to me. So the significance of this third point with regard to Scripture is that if our automatic response to the reports recorded in the New Testament is skepticism, then it's not because that response is rational. There's some other reason why that is our automatic knee-jerk response. Something else is going on. We're not just being rational. Point number four. Skepticism, however, is sometimes an appropriate and rational response to particular reports. It's possible to have grounds to be skeptical with respect to the particulars of some particular eyewitness claim. Because we know from experience that people get things wrong, then we know that we have to be on our guard, we have to be cautious, we have to be wary. There may in fact be reason why I can't take something at face value. And when I identify reasons for that, then to respond skeptically is a responsible and intelligent thing to do. That significance of that point with regard to Scripture is that if I'm going to treat a biblical account with skepticism, it must be on the basis of the particular details of that particular account, not on the basis of some general a priori skepticism that I turn toward a biblical account because it's in the Bible. That general skepticism makes no sense. But there, in principle at least, there's no reason why a particular account may strike me as problematic in a way that invites my skepticism. Point five, typically we have grounds for being skeptical of a report and considering its veracity suspect when the veracity of the report would have implications that do not obviously cohere with my own worldview, that is, with my own understanding of the nature of reality. So, if the professor goes out in the hall and a colleague meets him and says, I just put a memo in your box, I'm not inclined to be skeptical because my worldview doesn't make that somehow implausible. I mean, that's perfectly coherent with my worldview that sometimes, all too often, professors put memos in other professors' boxes. So that's not an issue. It's not incoherent. But if that same professor said, I just met a dragon in the in by the coffee, and he told me that Wittgenstein was wrong about that. Well, I don't go, oh, okay. Because my worldview doesn't allow for talking dragons routinely in philosophy departments. Anthropology departments, maybe, but not philosophy departments. So since my worldview doesn't accommodate that kind of information, my response is skepticism. Well, wait a minute. I don't know what to do with that piece of information because everything that I've believed up until now suggests that that can't be true. That can't be right. Now, typically, in our ordinary individual interactions, a direct and immediate reason to hold a report suspect would be if I know or suspect something about the inner psychological workings of the person talking to me. I can't trust them right now because they have an agenda, or this is what's driving them. This is their motive. This is their reason for not being altogether truthful and straightforward and factual in this report. I know something about their motives that tipped me off. The problem is, of course, that's not going to do us any good in the New Testament accounts because we don't know the people. We don't have any firsthand, immediate, direct information about whether they're trustworthy or not, what's driving them, what's making them tick. All we have is the report itself. But, so the only thing that we have left with, and this is not true of just the Bible, but any ancient document, any ancient historical report. The only thing I have to go on is how plausible are the implications of this report in the light of my own commitment to what I believe is true in reality. I understand the world in a particular way, I understand reality in a particular way, and I'm prepared to accept anything that's coherent with that, that conforms to that. But anything that doesn't conform to that, I've got to be careful. I have to think further. I have to look further. I have to examine further because it's not immediately obvious to me that that can be right. Let me give you some examples. If you were to tell me that you were crossing the bridge in Mapleton across the Siuslaw River and you saw a whale and its, what are they, calves? A whale and its calf swimming under the bridge. I'd go, really? But would I be skeptical toward that? I might be, but I'd be wrong to be. I mean, remember not too many years ago, or maybe it was way too many years ago right now, where there were all kinds of news reports about the whale that and its calf that came up the Siuslaw River all the way to Mapleton. It's an unusual event. A very unusual event, but it's not inconsistent. It's not out of the bounds of possibility of a reasonable worldview. But on the other hand, if you told me that I was crossing the bridge and there was a whale under the bridge that told me what the winning lottery numbers were, that would be crazy for me not to be skeptical toward that. Compare the account in the apocryphal gospel where Jesus as a child molds some clay pigeons out of clay and then tells them to come to life, and they come to life and fly away. Compare that to Jesus as an adult in the boat with his disciples, stilling the waves and the wind. On the one hand, they may seem comparable. On the other hand, they're not comparable, it seems to me. I'm skeptical toward the first one in a way that I'm not skeptical toward the second one. Why? Because the first one is Jesus simply putting on a carnival act of some kind. The second one is a meaningful statement made to the disciples in a performance, in a deed, about who he was and the nature of his authority from God. The one is just unusual. The other is meaningful and significant. That's why you hear all kinds of reports about the lady at Fatima, the Virgin Mary appearing to children and whenever he appeared to those children and made some prophecies. And you have all kinds of pilgrims that go to Fatima to this day. And there's a lot made of the prophecies of the lady at Fatima. There's that on the one hand, and then there's Jesus predicting Peter's denials. Now, both are making predictions. Both are making predictions supernaturally. Jesus predicting Peter's denials is in the context of a relationship with Peter, a relationship of discipling Peter, a friendship with Peter. There's all kinds of meaning in that. The lady at Fatima is making some strange predictions about history by a woman that I have no reason to believe even has any authority to make such predictions, let alone the capability of making those predictions. It doesn't fit into my worldview. I mean, it might as well be a space alien making those predictions, and I would be just as skeptical of a space alien making predictions as I would someone purporting to be the Virgin Mary, who's appeared several hundred years after the fact. I mean, given my worldview, it doesn't fit. Now, if I were a Roman Catholic, committed to Roman Catholic theology, committed to the Roman Catholic worldview, I'd be much less inclined to be skeptical toward the reports of the lady at Fatima. But given my worldview that I have, I think, on reasonable grounds, I'm not prepared to believe those reports. Compare Eusebius' accounts of the martyrs to the gospel accounts of the crucifixion. I'm skeptical of Eusebius' accounts of the martyrs in a way that I'm not skeptical toward the accounts of the crucifixion. Eusebius describes one story. It's very funny. I love the story, but I think it's just a story. I don't think it actually happened, of one martyr who was being burned alive, and there, as they always did, they make you hurt a little bit and then give you a chance to recant, if you will, before they actually do you in entirely. So they're burning him, I think, turning him over a fire or holding him over a fire, and they come to him and they say, "Do you have anything to say?" And his response is, "I think I'm done on this side. You need to turn me over." It was a wonderful story. But my worldview doesn't allow for that kind of superhuman spirituality. Not even Jesus himself exhibited that kind of superhuman spirituality. So why would some martyr be able to do that? More godly than Jesus? More spiritual than Jesus, more saintly than Jesus? I mean, what's with that? Pardon? Or more Catholic? Jesus suffered. Jesus was grieved. Jesus was sorrowful in the face of his death. Jesus hurt. Jesus was in pain. Jesus exhibited and expressed his humanity in the way that we would expect a human being to have to endure what he would endure. Not with a kind of glib wit, unless you watch The Life of Brian. which is another historical account. So if you see what I'm saying, the commitments I've already made to what I think is true and real and an understanding of reality are going to dictate what is and is not believable to me, and therefore will be the criteria by which I decide, will I be skeptical toward this or not skeptical toward this? Which brings me, okay, with regard to the scripture then, seems to me there are two implications for scripture. If I embrace a worldview that has necessarily ruled out the possibility of anything unusual, like a David Hume, a worldview that has ruled out the supernatural out of hand from occurring, then it follows rationally that one would be skeptical of reports of those occurrences in the Bible. That makes sense. Of course David Hume is going to be skeptical, because he's already ruled out the possibility of the supernatural. The other implication is, if the Bible were only giving us records of prodigies, you know, what I mean by prodigies are just merely random, meaningless, unusual events that don't usually happen, but they have no further significance. Prodigies are dogs with two heads and just things that are rare events. Then we might have specific reason to be skeptical of those records. But in the Bible, we don't have prodigies in the biblical accounts. We have what John calls signs, unusual events that have meaning and significance within the context of a specific tradition, within the context of a specific worldview, and within the context of a specific story that's going down. They have meaning and significance in that story. So we're not judging them as just mere prodigies. Prodigies, we have every reason to be skeptical about. Signs are different. If God is stepping into history to speak in a meaningful way, it's much more plausible that he would do the supernatural in that context than that he would just show off for the sake of showing off. Why would he do that? That's why I have difficulty believing that when you have fungus on a wall that looks like the Virgin Mary, I have a very difficult time believing that, that God has ordained that, that God has orchestrated that, that God is doing that, rather than us reading into that. Why? Because there's this big, huge question that I would have for God at that point. Why? A fungal Mary? What am I supposed to do with that? So to make the distinction between a prodigy and a sign, Jesus cursing a fig tree, as he did, and having it directly die and no longer bear fruit, that was a sign. It had symbolic value. It was an actual act of performance art that had meaning to the disciples. Jesus seeing a chicken beside the road and commanding it to grow a miniature monkey head is a prodigy. What would it mean? Why would he do that? We would have to believe of Jesus that it was just a random act of arbitrary carnival. Carnival missionship? Jesus stilling the wind and the waves is a sign. Jesus making the Sea of Galilee turn red, white, and green would be a prodigy. Jesus healing a leper is a sign. Jesus making Pilate's arms and legs fall off and then restoring them would be a prodigy. What's remarkable is you have none of that in the New Testament accounts. You don't have any of those spectacular, weird, bizarre carnival act prodigies. You always and only have signs recorded in the New Testament. Sixth point, a person's rational response to the report of a historical event is directly dependent upon that person's prior worldview, upon one's pre-understanding. That directly follows from what we've been saying already. If it is immediately obvious that the implications of some account that somebody is giving me are consistent with what I will call my pre-understanding, the way I've looked at the world up till now, then it's rational for me to believe the report unless I have some other reason to be suspicious of it. But if it's not immediately obvious that the implications of a report conform to my previous way of looking at the world, then it's rational of me to be skeptical of the report and to consider its veracity suspect. So what does that have to do with Scripture? If I have already embraced a worldview that rejects the existence of God and rejects the existence of the supernatural, then it's rational to respond skeptically to the biblical accounts of God and the supernatural. But if I have already embraced a worldview that accepts the existence of God and the supernatural, then it at least may be eminently rational, unless there's other reasons it's not, it may be eminently rational to respond with belief to the biblical accounts of God and the supernatural. Seventh point. If a report has implications that do not obviously cohere with my pre-understanding, my previous way of looking at reality, then it's rational to acknowledge such a report as a challenge to the truth of my pre-understanding. It is not rational to refuse to acknowledge such a report as a challenge to the truth of my pre-understanding. The seriousness of the challenge may vary depending upon various things that we could get into if you want to. I'm not going to take the time right now. But the point is, going both ways, to the atheist who's decided that God doesn't exist and the supernatural doesn't happen, if he doesn't read the New Testament accounts and have his very worldview challenged by what's being claimed in those accounts, then he's not being rational. He may find some way to stave them off and decide that they are not convincing to him and that he doesn't believe them. But if he doesn't even feel the challenge of those accounts, why not? Because what if they really happen? Like the writers are saying they happened. If they really happen the way that the writer said that they happened, what's that do to your atheism? What does that do to your view, your naturalism, your view that the laws of nature can't be violated? Something's got to give. And you may decide to reject the accounts in the end, but you ought to at least feel the pressure and the weight of the challenge that they present to you. By the same token, if it were the case, it's not, but if it were the case that we had a contemporary account from the time of Jesus that actually explained what happened to Jesus, why the tomb was empty, why the disciples sincerely thought that he had raised from the dead when in fact he didn't, they just made a mistake, an honest mistake, and explained why the crowds believed the disciples, and so on, and gave us a plausible account of how Christianity got going, even though Jesus didn't raise from the dead. Shouldn't we feel the challenge? Wouldn't we feel the challenge of such an account? I think we should. I don't mean we'd believe it, necessarily, but we would feel that as a significant challenge to my whole worldview. Now, some challenges would be more than others. If there were a contemporary account that actually space aliens came and took the body and then sent one of themselves to impersonate Jesus to the disciples, I'm going to take that less seriously than a more plausible account. But any plausible account, I should feel the challenge of that. The eighth point, then, whether one believes and embraces a particular worldview is not a simple straight-line inference from the reports of the historical events that give evidence of the veracity of Christianity. Rather, the two, Christianity and the events that Christianity is founded on, those two things exist in a dialectical interdependence, it's a circular relationship, a back-and-forth relationship between the two. And I explain that in the rest of this. My pre-understanding and my inclinations with regard to my particular worldview, say Christianity, they affect how I look at and respond to the historical record, those historical accounts. And the historical accounts affect how and whether I will embrace the particular worldview. So let me simplify that. As a Christian, the fact that I'm a Christian makes it significantly more rational for me to look at the accounts in the Bible and take them at face value and believe them. But in fact, at the same time, the fact that those accounts are what they are make it all the more reasonable and plausible that I embrace the Christianity that I embrace. And there's a kind of a circular relationship between the two. I believe the accounts because I'm a Christian, and I'm a Christian because I believe the accounts. But it's not circular reasoning, because it's not a straight line deduction from I believe in Christianity because I believe the historical accounts are rational. That again comes back to the big lie that we have swallowed. The big lie that we have been swallowed, that this is what's going to come up all over the place in our culture today because of the Da Vinci Code. The big lie in our culture is the reason I believe in Christianity is because I have taken at face value all the accounts about Jesus and his miracles in the Bible, and that's why I'm a Christian. And if you could show me that those could be called into question, then I have no business being a Christian. We've all swallowed that line of reasoning. But it's false. It's fundamentally wrong. The fact of the matter is, in the end, I either accept Christianity and to come to a way of understanding reality that makes sense of the entirety of it, of all of it. Historically accounts from thousands of years ago and my everyday ordinary experience today as I have to live with myself today. We want to make sense of all of it. And we're groping to understand reality in a way that can make sense of all of it. Well, in the end, we're either going to accept Christianity because we're rationally convinced that it makes sense of all of it, and when we do that, we put ourselves in a position to be far less skeptical toward the biblical accounts. Because part of accepting Christianity is accepting a worldview that makes those accounts be plausible, makes those accounts make sense. Alternatively, I may decide Christianity is a bunch of bunk, there isn't anything about it that makes sense out of anything in reality, and the whole thing is bunk. Well, of course I'm going to be skeptical toward the historical accounts in the New Testament if I decide that. So probably the most important thing that I can say today is to realize the different kind of relationship that exists between me and those events 2,000 years ago. I don't have to put on hold whether or not I'm a Christian until someone settles once and for all whether the historical documents, whether the Bibles are historically reliable or not. That was part of Kierkegaard's point, is that that's not really the issue. We're not waiting to see, make sure that the foundation is rock solid and that history really is the history that it is before I can get on with being a Christian in my life. Because if you put that on hold, it's going to be on hold till your dying day. Of course, it's going to be controverted by people. People can always come along and say, those are just legends, those are just myths, those are just lies. People just made that junk up. It's not really true. Well, how are you going to prove them wrong? Were you there? Well, of course you can't. Of course you can't establish with logical certainty that the accounts happen the way the accounts happen. But that's not what we're waiting for. What we're posed with is a question. We have a view of God and ourselves and the world and reality that Christianity, that the Bible presents to us, that's integrally tied together with these reports of what this man Jesus said and did in the presence of eyewitnesses who claimed we saw him say and do these things. You either accept the entirety of that or you reject the entirety of that. But you don't have to wait and see that whether or not independently of my belief in the existence of God and Christianity, those accounts hold up. Because how could they? Not because I think they're false, not because I don't think there's true, not because I don't think there's evidence for it, but the kind of certainty that you're looking for can't be had toward anything in history. There's whole segments of the world these days that don't believe the Holocaust happened. You can challenge anything in history because it's so far away. Who's going to prove you wrong in your rejecting it? Who can establish it with any kind of certainty? I just, whether I accept it or not, is all going to be a part and a piece of what I think makes sense out of the entirety of reality as I have come to embrace it. And that's the decision that everyone ultimately faces. Notice then that some things that are seemingly completely unrelated to that can be really important. For example, what was it that Jesus taught? Jesus taught that I was a sinner. Jesus taught that I was evil. Well, I can kind of test that from my own experience, from my own perspective. When he says that, is he not getting me profoundly right? Isn't that profoundly accurate description of me as a human being? Jesus seemed to know what he was talking about. That's all part of why I trust this man, is because he seemed to be so insightful into my life. And if somebody is that insightful into my life, it makes it all the plausible when he says to me, I have descended from heaven, and that's why I know stuff. I know stuff because I was sent from God to teach you, to give you insight, to give you perspective on who you are, because you're self-deceived and you don't even know who you are. But I can set you straight on that. And when he sets me straight on that, if I'm honest with myself, I have to say he's speaking truly about me. Well, that's part of why I believe he changed water into wine. Because I have reasons that are relevant to my own ordinary, everyday, daily existence, where I see him being insightful and truthful in a way that makes credible the claim that he's the Messiah. But if he's the Messiah sent from God, then it's altogether plausible that he could turn water into wine. It's all kind of wound together rationally. And notice then the interplay that implies that will exist between my response to the Christian worldview and the biblical accounts and my own spiritual moral propensities. If I'm someone who's unwilling to be honest with myself about who I am, and I hear Jesus saying I'm evil, then I'm going to want to be dismissive of his teaching, which means I'm going to want to be dismissive of his authority, which means I'm going to want to be dismissive of the whole worldview that gives him that authority. And so none of this stuff is going to make sense to me if I don't want to be honest with myself. So where I'm at morally and spiritually is going to play back and make a huge difference on what I am prepared to understand and believe. Almost out of time, so let's take a few minutes for your comments or questions.
Well, oh, there you go. It's actually a comment about the image of Mary in the mold.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw it on eBay, but there was a grilled cheese sandwich that was sold, I think, for $50,000 that had the image of God in it.
The image of God?
God or Jesus, one of the two.
That's an easier sell.
Yeah.
I wish I had thought of that. Great.
I just feel like there's something missing from this whole discussion, and I really appreciate what you had to say, and I agree with you, but what about the gift that God has given us of faith?
Okay.
That we can accept that because God has given us that gift. Beyond, I mean, it's not extra rational. It is rational.
Right.
But we also have that gift that not everyone has.
Right. No, that's exactly right. That's why you and I mean, when faced with this monumental choice, what view of reality are we going to embrace as the truth, as the light, and have it inform every part of what we are and say and do? Why did we make the choice for Christianity? Well, none of us would have done that on our own. What it comes down to, it was my last comment, the interplay between my moral spiritual condition and what I am able and willing to believe. There's different ways of characterizing it, but one way to characterize it is, if I'm unwilling to be honest with myself, there's no way Christianity is going to make sense to me. No way I'm going to accept it. Or that's not altogether true. What I do is I bastardize Christianity and turn it into something else. I believe a different Christianity other than the one that Jesus taught. But I won't believe the gospel of Jesus Christ if I'm unwilling to be honest with myself. So it seems to me that the place where God works in me, works the miracle in me, that is the gift of faith, if you will, is at that level of my moral spiritual condition, allowing me, against the propensities of my own sinfulness, to be honest with myself in a way that I wouldn't naturally be honest with myself. To be a lover of truth in a way that I wouldn't naturally be a lover of truth. To be someone who's willing to submit to God in a way that I wouldn't normally naturally be willing to submit to God. I mean, all those things need to be put in place before any of us would ever accept Christianity. Because if those things aren't in place, we're going to fight Christianity like crazy. And we're going to believe something else and rationalize why we believe something else. Namely, one rationalization will be, well, all those stories in the Bible are just bunk anyway. I mean, who can believe those? That makes sense?
Just for clarification, when you use the word skeptical or skeptic, are you talking about, if I'm skeptical, it means I will not believe, or if I'm skeptical, it means I'm agnostic and I'm kind of, I don't know whether to believe that or not, and I'm going to wait for evidence?
I was probably using it in a way that might include both. I'd have to go back and look at each use, but typically I think the skeptic is using it as a dodge. So they're never prepared to believe. I mean, they're not just being, it's different from caution. It's different from, I need to think about that and reflect upon that some more before I commit to it. It's a way of saying I'm never going to commit to that because I don't believe I could ever have good enough reasons that would make me commit to it. That's how I'm tending to use it.
One could raise the argument against you that if it is this cycle of my worldview and thus what I accept as true, that there would never be a place for evangelism or for sharing the gospel with others.
Because, why exactly?
Because I mean, you just kind of get more and more what you see in the world is confirmed by what you accept as rational. And so, like, however you stand, it just becomes more and more set in your own mind. And
okay.
Breaking into, like, one person breaking into another person's cycle would not work.
Right. Well, that would assume that we can achieve complete coherence in our worldview, but typically unbelief doesn't need complete coherence. It just needs to create enough semblance of coherence that I can be happy with my unbelief, that I can feel that I'm being rational in my unbelief. But this was the genius of Schaeffer and the tradition that he came out of. Is arguing that if you watch their life carefully enough, you'll find a place of incoherence even in their own worldview. And evangelism, effective evangelism, at an intellectual level anyway, is letting them see their own inconsistency. I mean, one of the favorite arguments of Schaeffer was, for example, taking someone who says, we're nothing but a bunch of stardust and, you know, atoms and chemicals and molecules, who is madly and deeply in love with somebody, and then point out to them, you know, they're just a bunch of stardust. I mean, what are you getting so excited about? I mean, how do you give an account of love which you can't escape experiencing and believing and living out in your life? you're not living consistently with what you're claiming is true about reality. And I think he's right about that. It seems to me that in the final analysis, the only worldview that can actually be lived out in reality without contradiction is the biblical worldview. Every other worldview is going to have some contradiction in it. I'm going to say one thing and live another way. I'm going to say life is meaningless and then pursue meaning in my life, live as if life is meaningful in some way.
So the point of communication would be at that point where a report challenges.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I don't take sides. There's a debate. I think Kurt may end up talking about this in a few weeks, but there's a debate that goes on about how to do apologetics, that is defending the faith. I don't take sides in that debate. I think there's a lot of truth in all those different schools of thought. I think by taking people back to the evidence and kind of probing and let them feel the challenge and the weight of the challenge of these reports can be very effective and important and useful. I mean, nothing is going to be effective unless the Spirit of God gives them the gift that Judy was talking about. I mean, that's just true. People are not converted because I was clever in the way that I evangelized them, or I used the right technique, or I was a powerful talker, arguer. I mean, that's not why people are converted. They're converted because God is opening their eyes. We don't convert people. We are midwives to the process of God bringing people into his kingdom, which is a very exciting thing to do. But if God is preparing their eyes, then any number of things that we might point to, all of a sudden they're going to see in a way they didn't see before. They're going to see the biblical accounts of the resurrection, things that they've been dismissing their whole life, and all of a sudden feel the weight of that. If this man really did raise from the dead, that's not nothing. And they'll feel the weight of that.
And on the flip side, if someone is trying to convince us of Christianity not being true, the only place for them to maybe gain a foothold would be in challenging, at the same point of challenging your understanding.
Yeah, finding some complete incoherence between what my worldview, what the biblical worldview is, and what I actually believe about reality. And that often happens. That's why a lot of people lose their faith, is because they don't really have a biblical worldview. They have a Christian worldview, but it's not a particularly biblical worldview. And between Christian worldviews and reality, there's a lot of incoherence. We say a lot of stupid things as Christians that can't possibly be right, can't possibly be real, can't possibly be in touch with reality, and yet we believe them. And someone comes along and points out the fact that it's not in touch with reality, and we go, whoa, Christianity's not true. And in a sense, that's right. That Christianity is not true. But often what they fail to see is what they should do instead is recognize, well, then that's not Christianity. Let me look for the real thing. But oftentimes they just, if they really aren't chosen of God and have not been given the gift of faith, that's the excuse they need to opt out of Christianity altogether. One last comment?
I just wanted to get clarification, the cultural lie that we've swallowed. I think your answer as to why it was a lie was implicit in what you were saying, but could you recap what it is? Is it that what Jesus has purported to have said and done, he didn't say and do, or ultimately? Could you say that again?
No, the lie that I was talking about is, let me see if I can make it directly with respect to Christianity and make it as simple as I can. That you imagine some atheist talking to you and saying, you have absolutely no right to believe that Christianity is true until you can prove that Jesus really did raise from the dead. And what they mean by prove, I mean, this is part of the lie. What they mean by prove is establish a kind of logical or mathematical certainty. It needs to be just as certain to you that Jesus raised from the dead as it is certain to you that 2 plus 2 equals 4. If it's not that certain, then you have no right to have faith. You have no right to believe that Christianity is true. And by right, they mean you're being irrational. You're being gullible. You're being intellectually weak. You're being just credulous. You know, you're just, people could make you drink Kool-Aid, you know. You're a Kool-Aid drinker. That's the charge. Well, it's a huge lie. I mean, what in their life is founded on beliefs with that kind of certainty? None. I mean, you can't have that kind of certainty about history. The reason you have that kind of certainty about logic is because it's logic. The reason you have that kind of certainty about math is because it's math. The reason you don't have that kind of certainty about history is because history is history and it didn't have to go that way. It could have gone lots of different ways. Of course it could have gone lots of different ways. It's logically possible that history is not what it is. But so, it doesn't mean that I don't know that that's the way it transpired. So, and why do I know that that's the way it transpired? Well, in coming to that decision, in coming to that conclusion, what I'm arguing is, part of it is because I know the rest of Christianity is true. And because the rest of Christianity is true, it makes very plausible, when I read the accounts of Jesus' resurrection, it makes a lot of sense that it actually happened that way to me. I acknowledge that if I didn't believe that all the rest of Christianity is true, I wouldn't be in a position to think that it made a lot of sense that Jesus raised from the dead in the way that they described that he did. But that's not where I'm at. I'm in a position where I know that Christianity is true for many, many different reasons, and that gives me a perspective and a standpoint and a worldview and a framework from which I look at the accounts of the resurrection. I go, that makes sense. Of course that really happened that way, because that makes sense. And my point is, against the charge, no, it's irrational to operate that way. It's irrational to draw a conclusion on that basis. My point is, it's the only way human beings can draw that kind of conclusion. What do you mean it's irrational? It's the way we were made to make that kind of decision.